this. Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Vinita Ujena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manovishtam Statutam Jena Bhutale Svayam Rupa Gadamayam Dadati Sva Padantitam Bandeham Shri Guru Shri Yutta Padakamalam Shri Gurun Vaishnavamscha Shri Rupam, Sagrajatam, Sahagana, Raghunathanvitam, Tamsajivam, Sadvaitam, Savadutam, Parijana, Sahitam, Krishna Chaitanya Devam, Shri Radha Krishna Padam, Sahagana, Lalita, Shri Vishakhanvitam, Scha. Vancha Kalpaturubhyascha, Kripa Sindhubhyevacha, Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha. Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya, Prabhu Nityananda, Shri Advaita Gadadhara, Shri Vasadeva Vrindavananda.
Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Hare
Rama. Oh, you're going to sit back there with the chairs, okay. Okay. So this is more kind of like an informal, or is it formal? More formal or informal?
It's informal.
Oh, okay, good. That's accurate. Relax then.
That means there won't be a test, right?
Oh, I have to. We'll cut that. Yeah, okay. So you have been studying Bhagavad Gita, and this just is another episode, another going through of the Bhagavad Gita, and so this is the kind of thing. Bhagavad Gita is the kind of book, as you know, that can be studied again and again. And each time you can get a clearer picture and deeper understanding of the knowledge and information there. You know, I find that that's kind of true with any book you read, that you can read it like once or twice, and the second time through you get, you know, added information. That's just regular old books. But in the Bhagavad Gita, you can read it once, twice, three, five, ten. It just doesn't stop. That's all. That's the difference. Because this is knowledge that's transcendental, deeper. It's not obvious knowledge. It's very deep spiritual knowledge. If you can clearly and continuously try to understand with the reverence, then a deep understanding, a deep breadth of understanding will develop. So that's our purpose, I guess. But before we're going to study the actual text and the ideas presented by the illustrious speaker of the Gita, which was who?
Krishna.
Oh, that's right, Krishna. Yeah, yeah. Oh, Krishna. The organizers here thought that it might be a good idea to present some kind of background about, you know, the what led up to the speaking of Bhagavad Gita, can you give it a little more context? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Good. Uh-huh. So we're going to talk about then, today we'll talk a little bit about the mainstream and the alternative views related to the what people call, you heard this word? It's kind of fancy word. Historicity. Have you heard that word? It's a fancy word. This means, is it really historically possible or true? Historicity. You know, it's a very fancy word. And then beyond that, after that, what are the circumstances which are usually described primarily in the Mahabharata, right? That led up to the Gita being spoken. Those two kind of main things we'll talk about today. So what number one was?
Historicity.
Yay, you got it. Yeah, history. And the other was what's the context of in the story, the kind of the storyline. Okay. All right. Number one, historicity of the Gita. Okay. You know, they say that when something's discovered, you know, a new discovery takes place in science or archaeology or any kind of thing, How long do you think it takes before that stuff gets taught to like the regular people like you and me? What would you say? Before it seeps into the textbooks that you learn maybe in junior high or high school, what to speak of, college maybe. But how long does it take?
At least 5 years.
You'd say five?
40.
Say 40. 20
years.
Yeah, 20. Yeah, you get all of
it. Depends on the subject.
Yeah, probably just depends a little bit.
3 years.
And to get into the high school textbooks, it takes, I mean, that's a little bit, yeah. 40 to 50 years, that's what they say. So somebody said that, yeah. So like, you know, what becomes really new stuff now was what was, you know, somebody had a great revelation in 1970. So that just, you know, and you're right, in some things it's different, some things it's more faster, and it'll depend on what the knowledge is, if that knowledge is consistent with what people already believe, or is it something that goes against what people, that has something to do with how quickly it may be assimilated into the, you know, the body of knowledge that people accept as true, but, you know, that's anyway. So, in that time, you know, that time, those 40 years, the information is debated, sometimes they debunk it, and support it for a number of reasons. It's not unusual that the discoveries are accepted or sent into obscurity, not just because of the strength of the evidence that supports them, but often on how the information provides support to the dominant paradigms that exist already. Okay? Yeah. So the Bhagavad Gita and related Vedic literatures describe an astonishing, you know, the Bhagavad Gita, part of the four Vedas, Upanishads, then the Itihasas and Puranas. Mahabharata is a Itihasa, history, okay, different kind of Vedic literatures. But they describe an astonishingly developed culture flourishing in India and other parts of the world 5,000 years ago. Now that's a problem, actually, for mainstream scholarships and Indology. They call it Indology. Did they fix that date of 5,000 years ago? Well, do you know how they did it? Somebody knows, come on. There's all these astronomical and astrological descriptions given at certain times of what happened. For example, before the Mahabharata war, it's a war that took place where Bhagavad Gita, Krishna speaking just before the war, there is described as a lunar eclipse and then just a couple of weeks later a solar eclipse. And it's full from that part of northern India was visible. So you can take a computer program and assuming that the planetary movements are kind of similar now than they were then, you come up with a date of about 3067 BC. Okay, and the date of, and there's another description of when Kali Yuga started. There were planets were lined up 180 degrees from each other on each side of the Earth, and Rahu was at night, you know, right overhead, and that's happened like two or three times since. What's that?
Where was K2?
Flat. 180 degrees.
K2
was
here?
Oh, yeah, K2 there. K2 there.
Rahu's there. And
K2's there.
Shade.
Yeah, right. Sure. Fine. So, that you can do calculations, and that was, 3102. That's when they described the start of Kali Yuga. So, wait a minute. The Mahabharata War started after Kali Yuga started. Well, the reason that it was because Krishna was on the planet, so it was.
Yes.
Okay. Anyway, yeah, you got it. Right. Okay. All right. Anyway, so there's these descriptions, but mainstream scholars say that Mahabharata was written about 800, 600 BC. You know that? Yeah, just shortly before Alexander invaded in Punjab and the northwestern part of Indian Pakistan, or South Pakistan. And not only that, but they say the literature of the Vedas and the Mahabharata didn't come from people indigenous to India, but from people, nomadic people, who invaded that area from like Central Asia, which is Russia and, you know, Kazakhstan, that part. And they came down, swept down with their horses and conquered the area. And they came with their ideas, which originally they thought they were an advanced people. That changed a little bit later. But they're the ones who the original, and now mainstream scholarship says, they're the people who wrote the Vedas, not the people living in India. And they say that invasion happened about 1500 BC or so. Then gradually they wrote the Vedas and stuff like that. So this is what you'll learn if you go to history class. You might have learned it. But if you go to the history class, so you have a class on this. And where this came from, it's a very interesting thing. That this came, there were some people some European people, when, you know, there was the British Raj, they were studying India, and when they were looking at the language of Sanskrit, and they thought, wow, this is pretty advanced. And originally they thought, well, this must have been the original language. But then a guy named Max Müller came along. He was a German Indologist, and he brought his theory. Now, the thing about Max Müller was, he was a Christian guy, and he believed in the Bible as the literal word of God. So, in the Bible, at least how they were understanding the Bible in those days, this is the mid-1800s to late-1800s, the earth, or the universe, was created about how long ago? 4,000 BC, right? 4,000 BC. And about 2,500 BC, there was the Noah's flood, and everything was destroyed, right, for some time. And then after that, that's when things started to get going again. So if you try to put the framework of the Vedas into that time period, it can't be, you know, it can't be, it doesn't work. So that therefore the dates had to be after that, you know. So therefore, 1500 is pretty good. Okay, so that was part of the information that was brought forward. But then, in the 1920s, there was an archaeological discovery in what's now Pakistan, and it's part of what's that? Sindh. Of these old ruins called Harappa and Mohenjo-daro, which you know about, yeah. So they're actually very, very elaborate things. They have, like, you know, citadel and granaries and baths, big, huge buildings were there, ruins of them, and on different levels, and not just in Harappa and Mohenjo-daro, but a lot of different places around there. So, kind of an advanced culture. Now, the problem is that when they started to date it, they found that this went back like 3,500 or 3,500 BC. So you got a problem here. When are the Aryans, the nomadic Aryans, they call them Aryans, invading? 1500 BC, and you got this Harappa and Mohenjo-daro is what? 3500 BC. So what happened? Well, they said, you know what? There's the guy who did the excavation. He said, this must have been pre-Vedic. These weren't people who followed the Vedas. They were conquered by these invading people from Central Asia, the Aryans who came from Central Asia. You know this stuff? And they had a bunch of reasons why, at that time, they had a bunch of reasons why they said that was true. And I have some here, which is interesting to know. Now, what I'm telling you, though, this is not accepted stuff. This is alternative. So people, I mean, not even now, I still tell you that just you know, a few years ago, they had some new textbooks in California. California is a very progressive state, as you know.
Hmm.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it was about the had some Indian history in it. And it said, you know, this standard stuff that, you know, the Vedas came from these invading Aryans from the central Russia and stuff like central Asia, stuff like that. So a bunch of people freaked out. They said, you can't do that. That's not true. That's true. So it was a big fight. And they were gonna stop and change the textbooks in California, the approved textbooks. I said it took 40 years. But then some guys from Harvard came and said, wait a minute, this is real scholarship. They had a big fight. Mm-hmm. And finally they came up with some compromise. But anyway, it's going on right now, this kind of stuff. Anyway, so the reasons they said the people in Harappa and Mohenjo-Daro, these couple of places in Sin, were not Vedic was because they didn't find any horse bones in the ruins. And they said in the Vedas, there's lots of talk about people riding chariots, right? You know, warriors and stuff like that. Even Mahabharata, you find people riding chariots and stuff like that. Well, so if there's going to be, you know, a Vedic civilization, it's got to have horses or some representative. They have these things, these little, they call them seals. They're not really seals. They're little, like about this size clay, almost like coins they have. And they have thousands and thousands of them in different warehouses almost. And they have on them sculptures of bulls and elephants and rhinoceroses. Is that where? Rhinoceroses. And hares and all kinds of stuff with a bunch of symbols on it. But they didn't find any horses on them. So they thought, but must not be Vedic. Must not be from, you know, Vedic. Also, they didn't find any remnants of or representations of chariots. Two big deals, right? No chariots, no horses. What's another big thing of Vedic kind of religion? Old India. You know, because you just had one at your place, certainly. Svaha.
Fire.
Yeah. They didn't find any fire sacrificial kind of altar stuff. So that's a really big thing in the Vedas, right? They didn't find any of that. Plus, they found 37 human skeletons. And some of those skeletons were all in a contorted kind of position. So the guy who did the excavation said, ha! These must be skeletons that got killed when there was the invasion that those Aryans invaded, right? Okay. So this is, and so then, and there's other reasons. There are kind of linguistic reasons about language and stuff like this. But these were the main archaeological reasons for them to say that that wasn't Vedic at that time. So now, if you say, think about it. If you know, the stuff you find in the Mahabharata and the Vedas and all that stuff is really not accurate. It's really you can understand it perhaps and then interpret it in a symbolic way instead of an actual way. Does that make sense? It's not really true. It's only symbolic, and that's the way that pretty much the Bhagavad Gita and the Vedas have been accepted throughout the world and also in India, for example. You're familiar with the father of India, Gandhi, right? Gandhiji. So he was a proponent of Bhagavad Gita. Did he accept the historicity of the Gita? You think? No. He said the Pandavas represent the five senses, right? Yeah. Well, so it was. It was interpreted in a symbolic way, not as a real thing that happened. It wasn't that Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, was talking. And the first vice president and became president of India, Dr. Radhakrishnan, same thing. It was symbolic. And once you get into a symbolic area, you can have a million different interpretations and it's all the same, because one person's interpretation is just as good as another, as long as it's not true. right? If the information presented is not literally true. So this approach to Vedic literature and the Mahabharata and Krishna's instructions fostered people to not really pay attention to the literal words of Krishna, because they can interpret them any way they want. And that's what usually was happening. Okay. Does that make sense, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So what were the arguments they had, why it wasn't Vedic, was, who knows?
They couldn't find horses?
No horses, or even representations of horses, or horse bones.
No fire sacrifice,
no chariots, and these skeletons were all messed up. And they looked like somebody killed them. You know, some invading hordes killed them. Okay. Then they went farther to say that, well, you know what happened, see? The people living in this Harappa and Mohenjo-Daro area, they were dark-colored people. And the light-colored Aryans came in. You know, Germanic, blonde-haired. They swept in, and they had a fight with these dark people. And the dark people ran away to South India. They became the Dravidians, who live in South India. And these white, light-skinned people, they're in North India. And so then there's been this conflict between North India. And you know where they got that from? There's a nice verse in the Vedas. It's called, some of you probably know, Tamasima Jyotirgama. You know that?
Yes.
All kids learn it in school, right? How does it go? Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Leave the darkness and go to the light. Which is really, it's supposed to be for spiritual development, but they've interpreted that, well, this is the what light-skinned people are kicking out the dark-skinned people. That's how they interpret. Really, this is it is. Anyway, but this is the prevalent view for, like, you know, almost 100 years. Almost 100 years. Okay. So the thinking is like this, that the since the descriptions given in Mahabharata and similar histories cannot possibly have taken place at the times and places that are mentioned in the writings themselves, they should be taken as symbolic only. And since they're symbolic, they need interpretation to have become their real meaning. Yeah. So as such, Krishna's words should not be taken literally, but need interpretation. And this is the view that's been disseminated in all. I mean, this is what you learn in India too, right? Even today, right? Yeah. You went to school in India growing up. Yeah. Despite information and points of view that have been brought to light over the last 50 years that shed considerable doubt on this point, these points. Okay, what are those things that have come about? Well, see, what happened was, during the time when the original excavator of Harappa and Mohenjo-Daro was a guy named Mortimer Wheeler, and he was a British guy. And, you know, excuse me?
Of course.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, and, you know, not that there's anything wrong with British people, per se, and then some of my best friends are British, right? But they had a purpose, and the purpose was to keep, you know, the richest part of the British Raj under control. So, when after 1947 there was the independence of India, then the Indian people started to their own kind of excavations, and it took a while. But what happened was they found that, you know, Harappa and Mohenjo-Daro now in Pakistan, they couldn't look at Pakistan because, you know, Pakistan and India didn't get along together so well. But they found hundreds of Harappan sites, as old as Harappa, in all around India, too. You know how many total sites they found? Have any idea?
108.
2,600, over 2,600, you know, villages and cities that they found of similar kinds. Some in Gujarat, and some in Sindh, and some in Punjab, and all kinds of them. Right. And in investigating these, guess what they found? A number of them had
horses.
You bet. You got horses, and not only horses, but they found some models of horses drawing
chariots.
There you got it. Yeah, horses and chariots. Well, that's very interesting, isn't it? And they also found
fire sacrifice
altars. Wow, isn't that interesting? And now another interesting thing that they found was that. many of these cities, in the Mahabharata, there's the description, and it's also in the Vedas, Vastu. And Vastu is, you know, how to make a plan of a house or a city so that it's harmonious with the celestial forces. So they found that many of these cities were laid out. And they're very detailed requirements for Vastu. Many of these cities are laid out in Vastu fashion. Some other kind of things they found out, that they thought about was, well, you know, it's a nice story, this invasion of the Aryans, but nowhere in the Vedas or Puranas or Itihasas do they talk about it. Isn't that interesting? Nowhere in that they don't find it about. So even though there's lots of stories, none of this is mentioned. That's interesting, right? Like, you learn about, you know, the pilgrims come over to America when you're in this country, right? Mm-hmm. It's a big deal, but nobody talks about this Aryan invasion and all the Vedas. Lots of writings, but nobody talks about it. Another thing they thought about was, well, you know what? What are the important rivers in the Vedas?
Saraswati.
Oh, you know about it. Jamuna, Ganges. What do you think of Ganges and Yamuna mostly? Yeah. But actually, in the Vedas, Saraswati is mentioned two or three times more than the Ganges. Although today, you don't see the Saraswati. And, you know, in the last 30, 40 years, they've done this satellite photography, and they find that there's a riverbed that went from the Himalayas down through the what they call the Gulf of, used to be Cambay, now it's Kambat. Very, very large river that was probably a few kilometers wide. But it, about 6,000 years ago, changed its course to go, instead of west, it go east. So here you have all this description in the Vedas of, you know, the wonderful Saraswati River flowing like a gigantic ocean almost and stuff like that. Well, if the Vedas were written 1,500 years ago and this river dried up 6,000 years ago, 1500 BC, but this river dried up 4000 BC, doesn't make sense, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And not only that, they found out that a lot of these Harappan cities were on the banks of this river. Okay. Non-Vedic, huh? Anyway. So, you remember those skeletons? Those skeletons, it turns out that they weren't all on the same level. They were in, like, different levels. Plus, they discovered that they didn't have, like, you know, they may have been in funny positions, but they didn't have, like, injuries, like broken skulls or anything that you would find naturally from people who had been, you know, attacked and killed. So they were on levels hundreds of years apart, which doesn't seem to be consistent with an invasion where they just come and take over. No. Another thing they thought was, well, let's, you know what? Horses and chariots. Now that works good on kind of flat type of land. But, you know, if you're nomads and you're coming, the Central Asian have plateaus and steppes and mountains and stuff like that. Horses and chariots don't go so well over mountains, right? So it's not practical, even if you're talking that these Aryans came up from there. Okay, plus, one more point. Plus, you know, like when people came over here from England, then you have cities named like
New York,
New Brunswick, stuff like that. Well, you don't have that. You know, all the city names are like, they're Sanskrit names in northern India and Pakistan and stuff like that before. Yeah. Plus, if you think about the, you know, the holy places mentioned in the Vedas, and some people are coming from Central Asia, all the holy places are, they're in India. You got, you know, Vrindavan, Mathura, Rishikesh, Haridwar. But you don't find any, you know, talking about Samarkand. Right? You don't find any. But if the people are actually invading from the Central Asia, you think, oh, the homeland is the most holy. And you find that. So anyway, these are arguments that the alternative people give that debunk the view of the Aryan myth, they call it, of 1500 BC, these people came in. Which, if we accept these ideas, that kind of clears the way to appreciate Krishna as a historical person and the events that took place leading up to the Mahabharata war as practical history, actual history. What do you think? Possible?
Mm-hmm. Right. Yes.
Okay, so that's I wanted to clear that way first. All right. Questions on this part? Yes, sir.
Is there any suggestion or proof that the British bitter liar guy, that he suppressed the ideas of that there were horses in...
Oh, I don't know. I think he was...
Because he was trying to fit into a Christian mentality.
Well, Max Müller was a Christian guy. He was pretty strongly Christian. I don't know that much about Mortimer Wheeler, about whether his, you know, whether it was conscious or not conscious. I don't know. I don't know that much about it. But most scholars accepted that there was no horse bones and stuff like that. And it went on for that way for several years. And even today there are many proponents of that theory still. But there's lots of people who are against it now, like I told you in California. So it's progressive Californians. Even though they had on the Schwarzenegger as their...
You know, now the Aryan invasion theory is not believing, right? They're disproving.
Well, that's what this yeah. But like many people, many academics in India and the United States and around the world still accept it. Oh, there was another thing I didn't mention that. You know, about 10 years ago, there was another discovery in the Gulf of Kambat, which is in western India. The state is Gujarat, and there's a peninsula that comes out. Well, that bay that's right under the peninsula is called used to be called Cambay. It's now called Kambat. Anyway, some Indian oceanographers were out there doing their work. This isn't Dwarka. But they found like these gigantic cities, like 20 meters under the water, 30 meters under the water, about 20 kilometers off the coast. There's two cities they found. Each of them is the size of Manhattan. That means that some of the buildings and walls there they found were 9 kilometers long. Mm. I mean masonry, bricks, you know, stones, mm-hmm. you know. 9 kilometers long. And then they found some, usually with carbon-14 you have to have organic material, so they found some wood there that they took up, and it was dated like 7500 BC, which would make it the oldest civilization. And this were, they're not, this isn't like a small kind of little village. Mm. They had, like in Harappa, they had like bathhouses and huge granaries and warehouses and citadels and temples and all kinds of stuff. But now that debate is going on. Yes?
They also found treasures, lots of gold ornaments.
In this place?
Yeah, from a Dwarka.
Well, the guy who did that was named Rao, and that was right off the coast of Dwarka. He dated that as like 1500 BC though. So, but this is like a lot older. So, you know, the question is this Vedic? We don't know yet. But, you know, according to, now, when you get into the Bhagavad Gita, you'll find in the fourth chapter, Imam Vivasvate Yogam Proktavan Ahamavyan Vivasvan Manave Praha Manurikshvaka Vibravit. And that means, in the beginning, Krishna says, I spoke the science of yoga to the sun god Vivasvan. Now, Vivaswan spoke to Manu, and Manu spoke to Ikshvaku, the father of mankind. Mm. And so Manu, Ikshvaku, was on the Earth planet like 2 million years ago. Oh, my God. Mm. 2 million years ago. What are you going to do with that? You know, that's a cognitive dissonance. But, you know, if the devotee was here, Druta Karma, and he presented, there's lots of evidence to show that there was developed human life, fully developed humans, millions of years ago. There was a very famous dig in Table Mountain in California, once again, where they came up with skeletons and stone tools and all kinds of stuff. And levels millions and millions of years old. But we don't hear about that because it doesn't fit in with the accepted theories. But anyway, we can go. We're just working with Krishna and Bhagavad Gita. But you know, but part of Bhagavad Gita is that this human civilization was going on a long, long time. Okay, so that's the first part. Then we wanted to introduce, you know, the conflict in the Gita, because here it's a right before a battle, and I'm sure you all know that this battle is between relatives. So how did it come? How did it happen that these relatives got so mad at each other and so that they were going to fight to the death? That's the question. So that description of how it came to this point is given in the Mahabharat. And the Mahabharat, which concludes the Bhagavad Gita, was actually written for people like us who are not really strong analytically or philosophically. And what it does is it gives Vedic truths, gives exemplary Vedic truths through the actions of saintly kings, sages, and devotees of the Lord in their interaction with, you know, the world. Particularly the history is about the Pandavas, who were devotees of Krishna. Now, the Mahabharat was spoken first by Vyasadeva, the author of the Vedas, and he spoke it to, he spoke it to? Ganapati. Ganapati. And, the deal was, he wanted somebody to, it was, actually the Mahabharat was, the full Mahabharat is 6 million verses, and that's understood by the demigods. That's accepted by the demigods. For people who are Gandharvas or lower, there's like 1,500,000 verses, and we have only 100,000 verses in human society. But anyway, Ganapati was scribed for all those things, and he agreed to do it, but he said, I will not do it. I will stop if you stop dictating. I have to pause and dictate. I'm not. So Vyasa is okay, but my condition to you is that you must understand when you write it. If you don't understand, then you can't write. So anyway, they worked out that deal, so that thing. So it was first dictated to Ganesh, then it was again spoken by Vyasa's disciple, Vaishampayana, in a sacrifice called a snake sacrifice, Sarpajagya. Because Janmejaya, Maharaj Janmejaya, his father, Parikshit, was killed by a snake. So he wanted to have a snake sacrifice to get rid of snakes. And then again it was spoken by Suta Goswami to the sages of Naimisharanya before the Srimad Bhagavatam was spoken. Before Srimad Bhagavatam. Had to be before Srimad Bhagavatam. Because in the beginning of Srimad Bhagavatam, Vyasadeva is unhappy. So Narada Muni, his guru, comes to say, well, what's the matter? And you've written all these big literatures like Mahabharat, Puranas, Vedas, Upanishads, everything. But Narada diagnosed the problem was that he hadn't dedicated a work to devotional service exclusively. So then he wrote Srimad Bhagavatam. So Srimad Bhagavatam is the ripened fruit of the tree of the Vedas. Okay. So mostly, the history, this Mahabharata deals with leaders. And in this case, the leaders are kings. Now, you know, kings are kind of out of fashion. Why is that? We think, oh, democracy is a thing, right? Really smart people and advanced people, progressive people, they have democracy as their political system. Because what do those kings do when they, you know, when they got power? They got corrupt, right? And of course, there's no corruption in democracy, right? Uh-huh. Anyway, but Well, Srila Prabhupada always emphasized that it doesn't really matter the method, but if the leader is God conscious, then they can be a good leader. Mm-hmm. And if they're not God conscious, no matter what you do, whether it's democracy, oligarchy, you know, any political system, communism is not going to work because they're influenced by material desires and greed, lust, those things. So, Bhagavad Gita was for the kingly people, the leaders of society particularly, to save themselves and other people from falling prey to corruption, which is going on now all over the place. Now, it's important to know that in the Bhagavad Gita and in the Mahabharata, this is a story, an unusual story for the people at the time, of leaders who started becoming corrupt. How was their corruption? Well, the characters were Dhritarashtra, he wanted to be king, but he was born blind. And for a person to be blind and a king in those days didn't work well, because kings had to be leaders of fighting on the battlefield. Now, you could be a blind Brahmin teacher, but not a blind king who had to do fighting. A mullah, you could be a blind mullah, but not a blind king. So he wanted to be king. He was jealous of his brother's sons. And when his own sons wanted to get power and take it away from the people who were rightful heirs to the throne, he abetted them. And that's the whole story of the Mahabharata. Dhritarashtra becoming corrupt, not following the law, allowing his sons to break the law and not punishing them or keeping them under control. That's the whole thing. And you know what? Do people in positions of power get away with stuff nowadays? You think?
Yeah.
You think? All the time, right? I think there were some banks and there was a bailout, but nobody went. Yeah. Those kind of, so this is the kind of thing that was happening. And this was why did Krishna have the war fought? It's to stop that kind of thing and bring his righteous devotees back in charge. All right. So that we're doing background. So the Mahabharata is incredibly long and complex. It's got all these plots and subplots, and they're all very interesting. And it goes on and on and on. It's incredible. But we got to start someplace. So, and some of you know this stuff already. But where should we start? I was thinking that we might start with. So we got all the characters. There's Shantanu was the king. You know, there's the Kauravas. You've heard of this. The Kauravas and the Pandavas. Actually, they're all Kauravas because they're all from the same line. Because the reason they're called Kauravas is because there was a king named Maharaj Kuru who was in that part of the world. And, you know, six descendants down from him, there's this king named Shantanu. So therefore they're all Kauravas. Yeah. And they're in the line from Ikshvaku. So this the solar dynasty. Okay? So then Shantanu, he married twice. His first wife was Ganga, the heavenly demigoddess. This is amazing. I mean, you know, I was talking to a friend of mine, and you know, he said that he teaches it at Rutgers, and he says he teaches Bhagavad Gita, but then he tried to teach Srimad Bhagavatam. But there's in the Srimad Bhagavatam, there's all these people who are so, you know, like demons, and so they have superhuman powers and all that stuff. And he says, well, people just can't accept it. It's, you know, think about it. It starts with Krishna, though. You got Krishna with superhuman. Well, if you got Krishna with superhuman powers and he can do anything, so then, you know, why can't other people? Why can't Krishna have other people who are doing amazing things? And now we don't see that happening very much, you know, in our realm. But, you know, in those days, there were much more communication between the people on our level, beings on our level, and beings on higher levels. And that's part of what's going on in Mahabharata. So Ganga was a demigoddess. She came. So then their son, Ganga and Santanu, was
Bhishma.
Yeah, Bhishma.
Devarata.
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, there's a story about how Bhishma, this is very interesting, very interesting. Bhishma, he actually was a demigod before also. And he and his brothers had come upon a sage's ashram named Vasishta, and Vasishta had a special Surabhi cow, Kamadhenu, that would give unlimited milk for sacrifice and ghee and all that stuff. So his wife said, "Wow, this wonderful cow. I have a friend on an earth, a girlfriend, and you know, why don't we get this for her? You know, I'd really like to make this a gift." I mean, his name in that life was Dhu. So he went along with it. They took the cow, the Vasishtha when he was away. He knew what happened, and so they got caught. And so he and his brothers all got
cursed.
Yeah, they all got cursed. But they repented. So Vasishtha forgave these first seven. But he cursed Dhu to have a long life on earth, and that he wouldn't have any wife. Right? So, now this is very interesting. When Bhishma or Devarata was born, and when he grew, did he remember this stuff?
No.
No. Even though he was a demigod. This is very interesting. So, you know, he's getting punished. And when at a certain point in his life, what happens is his father, after Ganga leaves, goes back to the heavenly planets, then his father doesn't have a wife, and then he smells this beautiful, wonderful scent, and it comes from a woman who's a fisherman's daughter named Gandavati, Satyavati, Gandavati Sen. Yeah, Ganda is scent, smell. Yeah. So he asks for her hand from her father, and he says, "Well, look, you're a king, and it was prophesied that my grandson would become king. But you already have a son. You already have a son. So I can't agree to this." So Shantanu was unhappy about that, and when he came back, his son saw that he was unhappy. They could say, "I wonder what was going on." And his father says, "Well," he didn't want to tell him anything. But Bhishma, or Devarata at the time, went to speak with the chariot driver who had driven him there, and he said, he told him what had happened with the not getting the hand of Satyavati. So Bhishma took it upon himself to go there and talk to the woman's father. And he said, "Well, thanks for coming." The father said, "Thanks for coming, but you know, I can't give my daughter in marriage to your father because I want my grandson to be king." So Bhishma Devarata said, "Well, listen, all right, I will give up the throne." Yeah, okay. Renunciation. But the woman's daughter wasn't satisfied. That's okay, yeah, I see you're going to give up the throne, but you could have kids, and then they'll take over, or they'll fight with my grandson. So Devarata then said, "Okay, I vow that I'll never marry." See, he was already cursed that way, right? He was already cursed that way. Didn't he remember? He didn't remember that, but it's funny how it comes out, right? So this previous karma came out, even though he wasn't. It was very interesting. Anyway. So then, and this is unusual, particularly for leaders, kshatriyas, they're, you know, royalty. You know, now you've got leaders mostly, they run around and have many different, and some they have many wives even, or serial wives. But so when this happened, Bhishma was praised, and with he was given the name Bhishma, which means one who has taken an awesome vow. Okay. And he kept that vow, actually. Okay, so that's Bhishma. Bhishma was the son of Shantanu. But then Shantanu married Satyavati and had two other sons, Vichitravirya and Chitrangada. Chitrangada got killed in a duel with a Gandharva. Yeah. Vichitravirya, he was there. And so when it came time for his marriage, Bhishma arranged to get the marriage with two women from the kingdom of Kashi. They were having a Swayamvara, and he went there and grabbed them and brought them back and married them. There was actually three, but we won't go into that one. So Ambika and Ambalika were two of wives of Vichitravirya. Then what happened is Vichitravirya got something like tuberculosis and died. So here they have these widows. There's no king. Shantanu already is gone. Bhishma's there, but he said, what was his vow?
I will not marry.
Yeah. And not marry and not be king. Two. Mm-hmm. Two. So then, So then Satyavati, who was interested in making sure there was a royal person. Now, this is interesting also, because, you know, you could just bring anybody up and tell them, you know, that this person could be a king, right? But there was this idea that there was a lineage and a training required. Just like, you know, in this country they have like purebred horses and, right? So, I mean, that's the idea. There's a certain lineage of people. Nowadays, you know, if you find the boys and girls get together, they go down to, the drive-in, and then they just kind of accept each other. That's all. But this is, you know, it was a very, very planned. So Satyavati said, well, listen, I made this vow of not getting married because of Vichitravirya, and, right, he's the grandson of Vasu, and so, but he's dead now, so what difference does it make? He said, no, I made this vow. So then he told Satyavati, well, you know what? In the old days, sometimes if they're, like when Parshuram killed all the Kshatriyas, Brahmins were called to beget wives in the widows of the Kshatriyas so that a new race of Kshatriyas would come. So why don't you call Brahmin to do this? So what happened was, Satyavati, who hadn't told anybody up to this point, she had a child before her marriage. See, there's a scandal going on. She had a child before her marriage who was Vyasadeva, the author of the Vedas. So Vyasadeva was born, the son of Satyavati, in the middle of Jamuna River and fathered by the sage Parashara. So in Parashara, he knew it was time for an incarnation, the literary incarnation of God to come. So she used to work, her job was taking people back and forth across the river because her father was a fisher person. So that was her job. So Parashara Muni, who was the grandson of Vasishtha, was being taken across the river. He said, okay, well, I'm gonna have a child with you. She said, I'm just a young girl. I'm not married even. What my father will say? What will people say? This is ridiculous. He said, don't worry. I can give you back your virginity. No problem. He said, what am I going to do with this child? He was such a... I mean, Parashara was a Muni, a saint. He was a mystic. He could do that. She said, well, the child will grow to full adulthood within a few moments. But what will people say? Well, I'll create a fog to change everything so that nobody will see. Then she said, I don't know, this is... So I said, I'll give you a boon. She said, well, you know, there's a whole story behind this, but I had this fishy smell on my body. If you could give me that repels people... You think of go to the fish market, it's that awful smell?
Yeah.
Oh my God, it's bad. Like people who don't eat fish, I mean, it's really bad. Even people who eat fish, it's awful. But, yeah. Anyway, so he said, you got it. So he gave her changed her bodily scent so that she could be her beauty of scent could be smelled for many miles around. That's why Shantanu got attracted by it. Anyway, so then Vyasadeva was born, and he said when he was born, he grew on an island. So his name is Krishna Dvaipayana. Dvaipayana means born on an island. Dvip is island. Vyas. So he was born on that island and grew to manhood. He said, whenever you need me, Mom, you think of me, I'll come. So then at this point, when there was no king, she, under the suggestion of Bhishma, she thought of him, and Vyas came and said, what would you like? What would you like, Mom? And she said, you know, we don't have any king. We don't have any king. So he said, well, what would you like to do? I would like you to be a children in your dead brother's wives. You know, there's a verse in the Vedas called, it says, Ashvamedha Gavalamban Sanyasa Padapaitrakan. Then there's the next verse, I don't remember. Yeah. But anyway, these things are forbidden in Kali Yuga. Horse sacrifice, cow sacrifice, sannyas is forbidden, and offering flesh to the forefathers and begetting children in your dead brother, in your brother's wife. So that before that was sometimes done. And the child would be considered the child of the brother. Yeah. So, anyway, he said, well, I hear what you're saying. If you're these queens, they're willing to perform sacrifice to purify their consciousness and like that, then I'll agree to that. But she said, there's no time. You know, there's no king right now. It's going to be bad. So you have to do it right away. So Vyasadeva apparently was not a good-looking guy. So he said, okay, if they can bear my ugly countenance, that will be austerity enough. Anyway, so then what happened was Ambika, and there was an arrangement so that they Vyasadeva and Ambika came together, and but she was so mortified looking at Vyas during the conception, she kept her eyes closed. So then after the intercourse happened, Vyasa left the room, and Satyavati said, how did it go? He said, the child of Ambika will have the strength of 10,000 elephants, but he will be blind, because the consciousness of the child is influenced by the consciousness of the parent. Yeah, okay. So Satyavati said, that's not good. You have to do it again. So then the next was with Ambalika, and that child was, she kept her eyes open. She was tipped off by her sister to keep her eyes open, but she was still afraid. So she had the next child was Pandu, but he was born of light color, which was considered like not good. That's interesting, right? Anyway, so Pandu, and then there was a third child born of a maidservant by the name of Vidura. Vidura was actually an incarnation of Yamaraj. Yama had, who's the lord of judgment after death for materialistic people. So Yama, what happened was, there was a sage by the name of Mandak Muni. Now Mandak Muni was quite a elevated sage, and one time while he was meditating in his ashram, some dacoits were running away from the constables of the from the police, and they tried to hide out in his ashram and act like they were yogis. You know, here's Mandak Muni was in meditation, and he had taken a vow of mauna. So these guys, they came in, they were doing, you know, this. And the policeman came up, they recognized they recognized the dacoits and grabbed him. But you know who else they grabbed? Mandak Muni too. Because they thought he was the ringleader. They were all in cahoots. So they brought him back to the king. There was a judgment. They were found, all of them found guilty, all together. And they were they were sentenced to be killed by being thrown into a pit with stakes, bamboo stakes. So they were thrown into the pit with bamboo stakes. But Mandak Muni, by his mystic power and his ability to control his pranayam, he didn't die. He broke off the stake and he was walking around with a stake. And so he talked with different rishis and said, what's going on? What's happened? I don't know. I was punished this way, but I didn't have anything to do. So with his power, he was able to go to visit Yamaraj. And he said, what's going on? How come this happened to me? How come this happened to me? So Yamaraj said, well, you were a great Muni. You are a great Muni. And we accept that. But in your childhood, you used to take pieces of straw and kill insects with that straw. So this is your karma for that. But because you're a great Muni, you weren't killed. So he said, what? That? I was just a kid at the time. I was just a kid. That's not fair. From now on, people who are 14 years or younger, they don't get karma, I say. And I curse you, Yamaraj, to be born on the earth as the son of a Shudrani. So that's what happened. Yamaraj was born. He could have avoided the curse because he's a great Mahajan, but he didn't. He came to participate in Krishna's pastime. So you have Pandu, Vidura, and Dhritarashtra, he was disqualified from being king because he was blind. So, and Vidura wasn't born from the royal family. So Pandu became the inheritor of the throne. Okay. We're going fast now. It's 8 o'clock. How long are we supposed to go for?
It's okay.
All right, remember.
Yeah,
Pandu, Dhritarashtra. Now, Pandu treated Dhritarashtra, very nicely. He was always kind to Dhritarashtra. So later, actually, when Dhritarashtra was lamenting when the Pandavas apparently died, he was said, Pandu was kind to everyone, but he was particularly kind to me. I had no quarrel with Pandu. So anyway, Pandu became, he grew to maturity. He married two wives. His first wife was Kunti, who he married in a Swayambhara. A Swayambhara is especially for the royal people. It's the king comes and the woman, who is also from the royal family, chooses among various suitors. Sometimes there'll be a kind of a battle of a trial of arms or show. They show off a little bit and then she chooses one. But she gets to choose whoever she wants. Swayambhara means. So Kunti chose Pandu, and later Bhishma arranged the marriage with Madri from the Madras province in South India. So there were two wives. Pandu was kind of renounced. He first defeated the kings all over the world. Then he went to the forest and was practicing austerities. But also, as a king, one thing that kings do, they hunt. Why do they hunt? Not everybody's allowed to hunt. Only the kingly guys. But they would have to practice their martial arts. And if they killed an animal, that animal, if it was like a higher animal, like a lion, tiger, so it was given a royal order of cremation, so they would get progress. But they would, lions, turtle they would shoot sometimes to so they could pierce the skull, the shell, yeah. So there were certain animals. Anyway, it was only allowed for kshatriyas. So Pandu was out in the forest and he was hunting, and there he saw a deer. And he shot the deer. And then he heard this terrible, horrendous cry. And he went there and saw that actually what had happened was he shot the deer. But the deer was a yogi who had changed into the form of a deer, and his wife was also changed into the form of a deer. And he shot a yogi who was only disguised as a deer. So he apologized. I didn't know that you were a yogi and stuff like that. So the yogi who was a deer said, well, just before he died, you know, I don't fault you for shooting, you know, because hunting is going on by kings and that's allowed for kings only. But what you did was you shot while I was having intercourse with my wife, and that's never allowed. So I curse you that if you ever have relations, sexual relations with your wife, you will die. So you got two lessons there. You know, even though hunting is allowed, it's not a good. It causes a lot of problems. It causes a lot of killing animals. Causes problems. You got this example. You got the example of Maharaj Dasharath. He was going in the forest, and along the river, he thought he saw an animal getting some water by the riverbank, and he shot. But actually, it was a human. And so he killed the human. That was Uttarakumari. What was it?
Shaman.
Yeah. He brought the Shravakumari. He brought the child back to the parents, and he said, "Well," and they were mortified. They said, "When you lose your child, you will die also," which happened. It was when Ram left, Dasharath passed away, and then Karna was shooting. It was hunting, and he killed a cow, and the owner of the cow said, "Listen, when you fight your heart's enemy, you're going to get stuck in the mud and you'll die. You'll get shot just like this cow is stuck in the mud." Anyway, so there's many, many, many examples. Parikshit Maharaj. Okay. And then the power of the attraction of man and woman is very, very, very powerful. So we'll see. So in spite of that, he stayed in the forest, but he wanted to have children. So he talked with his wife about his need, his wives about the need for children. And Kunti, his first wife, mentioned to him that, "Well, you know, when I was a little girl, I pleased the sage Durvas. And Durvas gave me a mantra. So that when I chant that mantra, any demigod could come. I could call any demigod and have a child by that demigod." She actually tried it, tested it out. But anyway, so she didn't tell that, though. She didn't tell that. But she was a little kid, she didn't. Yeah, anyway. Mm-hmm. So Pandu was very pleased. They discussed who they would, what kind of demigod, whose they should call. So first, they wanted a religious, pious, spiritual son. So the first demigod they called was Yamaraj. And Yudhishthira was born. Then the second child, they wanted a very powerful son. And they decided that the wind is the most powerful force. So they called Vayu. And who was born?
Bhima.
So Bhima is the brother of Hanuman. Then they wanted an illustrious son, and this Pandu performed austerities for a year, standing on one leg all day, to get the blessings of Indra. Indra was called, and so then Arjun was the child of Indra and Kunti. So those three sons. And then he wanted Kunti to call another demigod, but she said, no, three, that's too many people already. So he said, "Okay, well, can you teach the mantra to Madri?" So she did, and she called the Ashwini Kumars, they're twin gods. They're in charge of health. So then the sons Nakula and Sahadev were born. So those were the five Pandavas, Then shortly, you know, when Yudhishthira was about 15 or so, one afternoon, Pandu was in the forest and his wife was, Madri was there, and it was springtime and the flowers were blooming and the bees were buzzing. And he got attracted to Madri. She tried to escape, but he embraced her. And then just at that point, he passed away, so he died. And they had a discussion about who was going to stay with the children. There's two wives, no husband. Madhuri insisted that she wanted to go with Pandu to the next world, so she mounted his funeral pyre. This is what's called sati, which was outlawed in India, actually. Yeah, but so then Kunti agreed to raise all the sons as if they're her own. So then they went back to Hastinapur, which was the king, the capital king, city where they were came from. And then all of them, I didn't talk to you about the Kauravas. Okay. Well, when the Pandavas were born, the first Pandava was
Yudhishthira.
Okay. So at the same time, Dhritarashtra's wife, Gandhari, she became pregnant. So she was hoping that her son would be born first, because there might be some way that she could, that son could become the firstborn royal family, and then that person would take over as king. But it didn't happen. She was pregnant for like a year, and nothing happened, and she still was pregnant when she heard that Yudhishthira was born. So when that happened, she got so frustrated she hit her womb. And you know what happened? A lump of flesh came out. Oh, she was really freaked out by that. So she was about to just kind of dispose of this lump of flesh, but Vyasadeva came along. Vyasadeva is who? That's her. That's like... Actually, if you think about it, the Mahabharata is the story about Vyasadeva's family. That's what the Mahabharata is. Okay? Yeah. It's just descendants. So Vyasadeva came and said, no, don't. So he took the ball of flesh and separated it into how many parts?
101?
Actually, 101. Yeah, 101. One girl. 100. Because Gandhari had a benediction from Lord Shiva, she'd have 100 sons. So there was one and one daughter. So and they put him in pots with special ingredients to keep it, you know, and there was water poured over it every day. So gradually those sons, those pieces of flesh developed into embryos and then into children. On the same day that Bhima was born, the first of those pieces of flesh developed into Duryodhan. Bhima was born in the day, and Duryodhan was born at night. And when Duryodhan was born, there was a braying of asses and shrieking of crows. Vidura, he heard this and he said, "Oh, those are really bad omens." What it means is that this son is going to be the death of your whole family. So you should get rid of this. It sounds like something like Oedipus, right? Mm-hmm. But Dhritarashtra said, no, I can't do that. So then Duryodhan, then all of the 100 sons gradually came up. The second son was Dushashan. Okay, so they were there, and all these, the Pandavas came from the forest, and these Kauravas were there. We'll call them Kauravas, the son of Dhritarashtra. So they were working together. They played together. There was always some conflict between Duryodhan and Bhima, because Bhima was very powerful. And you know what kids do? They often wrestle. At least in those days. I know you still wrestle when you're growing up?
Yeah.
Sometimes, yeah. So anyway, and Bhima would always win because he was strong. So Duryodhan really didn't like that. He really didn't like that. So one day when they're out having a picnic by the river, when the other Pandavas were away, Duryodhan said, "Hey, listen, you know, I got some nice, really nice food for you." And he gave him some cake that was poisoned to get rid of him. So this starts at a young age. You know, they call it psychopathy or sociopathy, right? It usually starts at a young age, right? So he was so mad that he didn't win that he was going to kill Bhima by poison. So he administered the poison, and then Bhima became unconscious by the poison. Then he wrapped him up in ropes and threw him in the river to drown him. So this is, this is very important, because in Bhagavad Gita, these are sources of conflict. There's six kinds of aggressors. Six kinds of aggressors according to the laws. Whereas one of these aggressors, if they aggress against you, it's okay to kill them. A first one is if somebody administers poison to you. If somebody administers poison to you, you have the right to kill them. This is, you know, not nowadays, but in those times. Another one is if they attack you with weapons. Another one if they burn your house down. Another one is if they kidnap your wife. Another one if they plunder your riches. Another one is they occupy your land. These were allowed. Capital punishment were allowed for these six things. So what happened is that during the course of the Mahabharata, which we're hearing, all of these things were done by Duryodhana and his Dhritarashtra and his people to the Pandavas. Every single one of them. But you know what happened? Absolutely nothing. I was telling you before about when the big people get off with no punishment. That's here's the case. Here's the case. Later, so what happened with Bhima? He was thrown into the river, but there were some snakes there in the river. They bit him, poisonous snakes, and the poison from the cake and the poison from the snakes neutralized. This is protection by Krishna. This is protection by Krishna. Okay. So then the Pandavas, so that nothing. Dhritarashtra heard about this. Do you think he chastised Duryodhana? No way. Why not? You have a kid. There's different. I work with kids, right? So you have a kid. There's different kinds of kids. Sometimes the kids know how to throw a tantrum, and if they throw a tantrum and the parent says, "Yo, don't do that," and then the tantrum gets bigger, then the parent gives in. What does that teach the kid?
Keep
throwing those tantrums, right? So this is the Dhritarashtra Duryodhana principle. So, you know, sometimes Dhritarashtra would say, "Oh no, that's not a very good thing," but Duryodhana would just behave badly more, and Dhritarashtra would go along with it. So, this was one. The second thing, a short time later, Duryodhana and his company, who became Karna and others, they wanted to send the Pandavas to a nice city, Varnavata, which is a place of Lord Shiva, and so that he could murder them by burning their house down. This is called the house of lack. Now, what is lack? Lack is the stuff that's on the outside of an apple. The shiny thing on the outside, that's lack. It comes from the backs of insects that feed off pine trees. So you get a lot of these insects get on pine trees and they eat the pine tar, and then their back, their carapace, gets sticky stuff. So what they do is they take all these insects and they boil it, and they take the stuff off. That's lack. Shellac. That's where shellac comes from. Nice, huh? That's shellac. So anyway, so Dhritarashtra, under the influence of Duryodhana, calls the Pandavas, and especially Yudhisthira, says, "Hey, come on. There's this beautiful, beautiful city that we're building a nice house for you to go and vacation because we like you so much." You know? So anyway, he influences them, they talk about it, and finally he uses his influence on Yudhisthira to go to the city of Varanavata. It's another aspect of it. It's not just that Duryodhana is doing nasty things, but Dhritarashtra uses his authority as the elder uncle to enable the evil deeds of his son. If it was just Duryodhana doing it, so this also is a very prominent theme, not only then, but now. People in power using their power over others to enable nasty, bad doings. Okay, so anyway, I know it's getting late now. We're going. So there was, they went to the city of Varanavata, Yudhisthira and his brothers. On his way, Viduras commented in Mlecha Bhasha, which is a special language for Mlechas. Mlecha means lower class. He said, you know, there's a weapon that's more powerful than iron, but the snakes in the holes don't bother about that. So Yusuf could understand fire. We'll look out for fire. So they went to this newly constructed palace, you know, and they and Dhritarashtra, the person who constructed the palace was named Parochana, and he was given said great caution. You have to hide any of the evidence of it being flammable, even though it was covered with flammable material. They had put all kinds of scents and other things. But as soon as Yudhishthira walked in there, he could immediately tell, this is a problem. So he got in with all of his brothers, and they made a plan, along with a miner, to dig a hole out the bottom. And every day they would go out in the forest, looking, sightseeing, bird watching, while the miner would dig the hole for escape. So on a certain night, a dark moon night, after about a year they were there, they had a party. And it just so happened that a Nishada woman, which is a lower class woman, and her five sons came there. Now, this is very interesting. At that time, that was the night when this was supposed to happen. They had found out that this was supposed to happen. The fire was supposed to go. So instead of allowing it to take place unpredictably, Bhima set the house on fire and escaped down the tunnel. Now, what just so happened to the woman and her, she had five sons, they were killed in this fire. Now, if you think about it, wait a minute. If you burn a house down and there's people in it, aren't you guilty of murder?
Yeah.
So what about this? Here, Bhima burned this house down, killing these five people. I also had a problem with that. I asked a lot of different people. Nobody knew. So I was looking at the old commentary by Madhvacharya, you can see. Madhvacharya. And he says, he was actually, Madhvacharya is an incarnation of Bhima also, that these five, the woman and her sons, were relatives of Parochana. They had come to poison the Pandavas so they'd be unconscious when Parochana set the house on fire. So they were all part of the conspiracy. So that, you know. Good to know. It's not that you just can kill people because they're low class. Nah. Yeah. So, the people in the city, they thought the woman and the five sons, because Kunti was there, was the Pandavas and Queen Kunti. And so word was sent to Dwarka that the Pandavas were killed. And so Krishna came to their funeral. Did you know that? Yeah, Krishna came to their funeral.
Mm-hmm.
This is from when, right after, this is what happened when Satyabhama's father was killed in Dwarka while Krishna was away at the funeral. That's very, very interesting. Okay. I'm going too far now.
I don't know if you're available next week, if you wanted to pick up again next week.
This might be too boring for people.
No. I think, I really think that you did it in a very interesting way. And I asked you in the beginning if you would need a second week. I think you need a second week. Because you gave, in the beginning, a very detailed explanation of why people accept the scholarly understanding, which is good if you want to present this. So that was really nice. And you've gotten so close. Why rush it?
Okay, so we got to the house of Shalak. House of Lack. House of Lack. Okay. So we got the poison. We got the burning of the house. The burning of the house. So we still have occupying the land, kidnapping the wife, and plundering of the riches. And then right before the battle, there's the time in exile, and then the Peace Commission. This is really important. There was a guy on Sunday, you know, this guy on Sunday was asking a question because Balabud was talking about the battle, and he said, well, you know, what makes it right for you know, people to kill? It's not, you know, like we were saying, that a lot of the people who interpret Bhagavad Gita don't say that there was actually killing going on in the battle. It was all symbolic. But it's really important to know that so many steps were taken to try to avoid the fight. So many steps were taken, but it was insisted upon. And even so, the people who were involved in the fight were not the... there were no civilians there. No civilians were killed. No children were killed. There were no drones. There was a drona. Dronacharya. You know, I mean, nowadays war, I mean, we get so, nowadays war means killing innocent people. That's what, you know, that's what it is. But in those days, there were very strict guidelines about that, which didn't, these people don't do it, don't follow anything anymore. Okay, yes.
So, one question. If Dhritarashtra was the elder son, and he was disqualified, wouldn't his son be the next in line to become the king when they grow up?
If he were the oldest.
Right. Oh, okay.
If he was, that's why Gandhari was mad, because she wanted her son to be born first, and he wasn't. So that's why she hid herself in the womb.
So it wouldn't be the oldest son of the oldest brother, but the...
Yeah, the oldest of the total. Uh-huh.
Thank you.
You bet. Yeah.
I heard you said... under 14 years, there is no karma for children.
Yeah, that's what happened by Mandakmuni.
Yeah. Is it?
I
thought for 5 years or 6 years.
Well, this is what the Mahabharata said. Okay. I, you know.
No
change. So, I mean, should we have is it okay for 12-year-olds to start killing people? No, I bet.
I mean, whatever they do, reactions will go to the parents.
It didn't say that.
Other yogis came and sat with Mandakamuni.
Yes.
And then they put it in the bamboo trees. Who did that?
What's it? I don't know the question.
I mean, you said that some yogis also, some dacoits came and then sat with Mandakamuni.
Yes. Yeah, they were dacoits, yeah.
And then somebody put them in bamboos.
Yeah, that was the king's guys. Because they were indicted, they were tried and sentenced. They were sentenced to death. So they were all sentenced. So those guys actually died. But the Muni, he got, but he didn't die. You know, like when Jesus Christ was crucified, some say that he never died. And yogis in India, they can bury him in the you know, they'll bury them underground, and a month later they could come up because they know how to keep themselves alive by pranayams. So it's like that. Okay. Hare Krishna. What does this have to do with Bhagavad Gita?